Hi, everyone. Welcome back to Beyond the Couch with Bridges Mental Health. I'm Diana, and I'm really looking forward to chatting with our guest today, Rosa Lim, who is a member of the Bridges clinician community. Rosa is a licensed clinical psychologist in New York City who has worked in private practice and in college counseling for the past 20 years. Currently, she is involved with the William Allison White Institute's Eating Disorders, Compulsions, and Addictions program as both a member of the steering committee and as guest faculty. So welcome, Rosa. It's great to have you here today.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Great. Can you tell us first about yourself, how you came into the work of therapy and more specifically into specializing in eating disorders?
So my family and I immigrated here from Korea, from Seoul, Korea, when I was 10 to Texas. And it was a very life-changing and traumatic experience for me. Mm-hmm. So that sort of got me into thinking about getting into psychology. And then also as part of sort of acculturating, I use food as a source of comfort and sort of stress management. And so that also got me interested in specifically looking at eating disorders and how people use food.
Really interesting. Yeah. Can you talk more about what disordered eating is or how one would classify an eating disorder?
So I would say it's any type of obsession or preoccupation with food and eating that has detrimental effect on either like or and emotional, mental, physical well-being. It can bleed into social interactions, close relationships, as well as occupational functioning, right?
Yeah.
And it's often accompanied by this kind of preoccupation or distorted body image, whether it be body shape, size, or even just a number of, the weight.
Yeah. As you describe the characteristics and features of disordered eating, I would guess that a lot of people deal with some degree of this at any point in their life, right? I mean, we're all
definitely
eating, especially over the past 2 years, right? Eating very differently and mm-hmm. so many emotions attached to food, right?
Mm-hmm. And also, recently there's been a lot more research about eating disorders among like women of color. Uh-huh. Previous to that, it was only sort of thought of as, like upper class or upper middle class, cisgender white women who had this. And so what they're finding now is that the prevalence of eating disorders, not at a clinical level per se, but subclinical, is on par among Asian American women with white women. And mainly what they're finding is binge eating.
Interesting.
And with some like restrictive eating. Yeah.
Okay. And in the research, is there any indication of some of the factors that mediate that? And why is it binge eating or restricted eating that comes up for women of color?
Specifically for Asian Americans, I think it has to do with partly the acculturation level. Mm-hmm. So what they're finding is that high prevalence of eating disorder is found in second generation versus like either first or third generation. And you okay. can sort of think about it in a way of second generation becoming sort of this bridge between the first and the third. And they're the ones who are having to, I think, negotiate a lot of the acculturative stress mm-hmm. rather than the first or the third. Yeah. And this is also sort of, it goes along with other research that's been out there in terms of acculturation stress having more of a predictive like factor of developing binge disorder among Asian American women. But also I think eating disorders in general sort of fit into Asian culture in a sense of things being sort of hidden, especially like overt expression of emotions is not very much encouraged.
Yeah.
So it sort of goes with like the traditional social norm in terms of gender norms, as well as this kind of expectation of, you know, you shouldn't really be very expressive about what you're feeling, as well as just keeping the peace and keeping things sort of concealed under wraps.
Okay. And so disordered eating is a way to express some of that in a covert way. Okay. Yeah. I mean, the other thing I think of is like swallowing our feelings or something. And so consuming, you know, stuffing it down or something, right?
Right. And it goes along with sort of like, if you think about identity and having a voice, right? And sort of eating your own words, or, you know, in any of those kind of like popular sayings, or even just metaphors, it's about sort of keeping things in rather than having an avenue or feeling safe enough to actually express something.
Yeah. Can you talk a little bit more about some of the, I guess, the themes that you noticed in your Asian American clients that struggle with disordered eating emotionally?
There's a lot of, so acculturation stress is a major thing. So intergenerational conflict. So having to negotiate like parental kind of demands and family expectations versus sort of meeting with dominant culture, or, you know, what will be acceptable or will be encouraged among peers. Also, there's sort of like high demand of from the family to be perfectionistic or to achieve. That's a very common theme. There's also like this, what you talked about in terms of like being silent, like sort of like self-silencing or lacking a voice, right? Lacking a sense of identity, even if it's like hyphenated identity, sort of lacking a sense of self. That is pretty common that I found. And also history of trauma. I think that's, whether it be emotional or physical or sexual, that I've also found a lot.
Yeah. What would you say are the biggest challenges in working with your clients on disordered eating, given that there's a whole constellation of factors that may play into it or be connected to it?
So half the clients that I see, they don't come in with this awareness that there's something going on with the eating or the body, right? Mm-hmm. We sort of get to it as a part of just treatment.
Yeah.
Some people actually come in because of the symptoms are becoming very distressing and it's beginning to interfere with literally like their daily functioning, whether it be like they're vomiting too much, that like they're having problems with their teeth or their oral health, or in cases of anorexia, then, you know, they're losing hair, they're having like really problems with early onset of, what do you call it? Like, it's not a menopause, but it's
Like amenorrhea or something.
Amenorrhea definitely, but from the amenorrhea, your hormones get out of whack, and then you get early onset of osteoporosis.
Oh wow, yeah.
And then also that could also, amenorrhea can also affect your fertility, and so people who have had actually anorexia in their teens may not be able to get pregnant later on in their lives. Okay. So, I mean, there are a lot of like dire kind of physical consequences. And so some people do recognize it and they want immediate symptom relief, whereas other people, it sort of comes up as we are working together, and then they may, you know, kind of mention here and there, oh, you know, I was really stressed out, so I just had a lot of food and I threw up. And then we begin to kind of talk about it. So with those people, I think it's more challenging because they don't really see it as a problem, and they can still function, and for all intents and purposes, like they can keep it under wraps and nobody knows.
Yeah. Yeah. And I guess along those lines, how would you then sort of define progress, or how do, I guess there's a range as well, right? For the people who are seeking symptom relief and then the people who don't even realize that it's an issue. How would you identify progress with your clients?
I would say to the degree of how much attention it's given, like to food or to body, weight or shape or size or just in general. And one another thing that I want to add is this, it's not only about actually about the body weight and shape, it's also about Asian features that I found. There seems to be like this correlation of people who desire a lot more like Western kind of features also tend to have like disordered eating or outright like eating disorders. And I know that it's becoming pretty like standard in Korea to have like a nose job and the eyelid surgery. But even here, there's like among Asian American women, especially the number one plastic surgery is the eyelid and the nose.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so I think that also then correlates to, you know, the ethnic identity and how tied they are to their own sort of culture versus like the dominant culture at large.
So it seems to follow that Asian Americans or Asian Americans that experience disordered eating may view that as part of assimilating to I guess white culture.
Yes.
Okay.
So it's so again like wanting to kind of fit in, wanting to become like part of the dominant culture, mm-hmm. become the like the social kind of norm, right? Not wanting to stand out. And also there have been studies done with development of eating disorders with like experiences of oppression and discrimination, whether it be because of the ethnic physical features or just outright like just verbal like mm-hmm. abuse.
And do you find differences in people that are binging versus people who are restricting, like what sort of perspectives they have on this sort of like definition of beauty, of fitting in?
You know, I mean, Asian culture in general, they sort of, there's this like paradox, right? Because on the one hand, you know, you like when you're little, it's sort of good for you to be like a little chunky. And then especially for women, and then when they grow up, then you're like sort of having to fit into or try to fit into this like really thin,
yeah,
very like small boned, like kind of image. That's one part of paradox. And then the other part of paradox is this idea of filial piety, where like adults, like you have to respect the adults. So like when they give you food, right?
Yeah.
It's very rude to refuse or not eat it. And so then what do you end up doing? It's sort of like
a double bind of,
yeah.
Yeah. And there's just a lot of negative emotion wrapped around that, right? And also like not having autonomy over your body or the ability to
right,
say no.
Because it's almost in a sense like it's a shared body, right? It's not only you representing yourself, but also there's this idea of, you know, like the family narcissism, you're representing your family outside the family to the world. And so you have to sort of, a lot of families, I think this way, like you are like,
we're all, yeah.
Right. And so, you know, you have to look at for the family. So if the family is thinking the Asian ideal, like body type is this like very slender person, then you're going to work towards actually like achieving that, not only for yourself, but especially for your family. So then the family relationship and how far or how much to kind of negotiate your independence or your sense of self away from your family becomes like a very central issue in a sense, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Depending on how rigid it is at home, right? Like
mm-hmm.
it may seem like, all right, well, I guess binging makes sense, right? This is one way I can achieve this without needing to have conflict with anybody.
Mm-hmm. But the difference also, you know, like what you said about, you asked about in terms of bingers versus people who restrict. In terms of like attachment or the way that kind of they attach, the attachment style per se, like in their relationship, is that a lot of the bingers are able to sort of be more open and have more of a back and forth.
Mm-hmm.
And they tend to be more of caretakers,
mm-hmm.
what I found. versus the restrictors are more sort of like closed off, right? And they're not as emotionally available. That's what I found.
Let's say someone who's listening today recognizes that they may have some disordered eating patterns. What would you recommend that they do?
Well, you know, first of all, like eating disorders is a way to disconnect emotionally and to, I think, express your emotions covertly. And so I think part of it is to really educate yourself on it, right? And so you can do, you can either read books on eating disorders, or you can also go to these websites. Like there's a National Eating Disorders Association website, which also has like a questionnaire that you can fill out that would sort of tell you, you know, like whether or not you have eating disorders. There's also Academy of Eating Disorders. It's also a website that has a lot of resources. Mm-hmm. There's also Eating Disorders Anonymous, which, you know, along the, like the 12-step thing, it's just, you go to groups and just kind of feel supported and just get to know, like, you know, what, how other people are dealing with it, or how other people are doing when they're struggling with food and body image, right? And for the clinicians who are listening, I think there are a couple of really good books. One is called Sick Enough, which is sort of talks about the medical complications that comes with eating disorders, whether it be like anorexia, bulimia, or binge disorder. And I don't even think we got to orthorexia, which is not in the DSM-5 yet, but it's sort of up and coming, and it's becoming very prevalent among what I've seen are athletes and performers, mm-hmm. where there's this that sort of emphasis on like quote unquote clean eating,
yeah,
which sort of goes awry, and then they begin to really restrict the range of food that they take in, and also they begin to sort of not eat out and not eat food prepared by other people, and
yeah,
it gets more constricted as time goes by, right?
Yeah. That is really interesting, because I've noticed that too, just anecdotally on Instagram, people who are recovering from some sort of chronic illness or have autoimmune issues or are vegan or are some proponent of one of these diets, talking about all the benefits of it. And it's like so tied to wellness now that it's really hard to parse through the information to know, like, is this something that is clinical? Is this something that is healthy? And yeah, I definitely have seen a lot of that on social media.
Yeah, again, I mean, I think for people to kind of judge, is this like really problematic or not? I think they have to really just kind of sit and think about like how much time and energy am I really dedicating to thinking about food, or like the way that I look, and, you know, that type of thing. Yeah. And then if they're thinking, oh, maybe it is sort of a little bit going overboard, then, you know, they can begin to sort of educate themselves and see. It's also, I mean, if they're concerned, I mean, certainly they can go and see somebody, right? And it's always like good to be in therapy, especially if you're, I mean, I would assume that if you're kind of stressed out about those things, I'm sure there are other things that are causing a lot of stress. So
yeah.
Another book for the clinicians is called Hungers and Compulsions. Mm-hmm. It's by Jean Petrucelli, and it's sort of like psychodynamic, sort of it talks about the underpinnings of like how an eating disorder develops, or how just compulsions in general, right? Because eating disorders is also just part of this anxiety disorder spectrum. And if you think about it, it's almost like you can substitute the food for any type of addiction or compulsion, whether yeah. it be like drugs, alcohol, right?
Yeah. I think you actually answered my other question, which was how would I know I even have an issue, you know, with eating, right? But it is about just, you know, reflecting on how much of it, you know, how much is thinking about food and what I'm eating, you know, consuming in my mind, right? Like how much space, how much time I'm spending on it. And I know we're sort of jumping around now, but after you spoke about this, I'm starting to wonder, like, what sort of approach do you take when you're working with someone who has an eating disorder?
Well, my approach is eclectic. So I try to get the person's sort of narrative, their history, and sort of look at them psychodynamically that way. Mm-hmm. And then because, you know, part of eating disorders is this disconnection with food and the body, actually, I try to sort of integrate somatic work into it, as well as like cognitive and behavioral work as well. Mm-hmm. And so whether it be like, you know, it depends on whether the person has anorexia or bulimia or binge, but, you know, it's good to like sort of have like a log that the person can actually, you know, like write down and reflect on. And also just sort of doing more of like just regulating the body, whether it be through like breathing, yoga, or just sort of working with the nervous system. Mm-hmm. I also work on, you know, like, especially for binging, whether it be through just binge disorder or bulimia, work on identifying the triggers for it, and also identifying just a little bit of like DBT also, with just sitting with the feeling. So then just making contract to sort of like sit with it a little bit at a time, and then making the time a little bit longer and longer, and then coming up with like alternative ways, you know, coping strategies that they can first go to rather than just resorting to eating, with the understanding that, you know, they could always resort to food, but trying these other things. So, I mean, it just, but also, I mean, just working on the relationship, right? And mm-hmm. and also because part of it is this rift in attachment that caused them to develop the eating disorder. So it's about like building trust, and not even just between the therapist and the client, but also just within themselves, because they don't ultimately trust themselves to know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I'm curious, is there like a certain age group where people are coming in more frequently with disordered eating?
It's getting younger, unfortunately.
Yeah.
I mean, it used to be like teenagers, but now, you know, like third graders. I mean, I refer them out, but I mean, it's getting really young.
Yeah.
I think that it also has to do with onset of like puberty.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, girls are starting their periods a lot younger. And I think there's a lot of like issues with just discomfort with like the changing of the body, which then just kind of get them to focus on the food.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. I feel like I could ask you many more questions about this topic. I think it's definitely an area that is such a specialty, and that anybody, any clinician who doesn't specialize in it really knows that this is like, you know, out of their wheelhouse. So I think it's definitely one of those areas that unless you explore, you know, specialty training, it's not something we get a lot of training in at school, at least for, you know, in master's level programs. But it's always been really interesting. I've read about the studies about, you know, that's a, you know, white woman's disease, or, you know, feeding of refeeding programs. Like that was maybe the only thing that I learned about eating disorders in school. So yeah, it's definitely really interesting. And I think, especially now as everything has gone to teletherapy, mm-hmm. I think there's also like this feeling that, oh, well, how do we work with people if they come to us with something like disordered eating? Like, how would we be able to really work well with them if we're only seeing them on video and we don't really, you know, so there's like
that a lot is of- actually a very difficult part, because mm-hmm. you don't get the sense of the whole person in person.
Yeah.
Because you can't really tell from, you know, like the chest down, like what they're looking like. And you can sort of also like pad yourself. I mean, they do that in person anyway, but it's just, it's hard. Yeah.
Yeah,
definitely. That's a good point.
Yeah. Was there something else that you were going to say before that? I think I interrupted you.
Yeah. And in severe cases, I mean, you would have to have like medical support, right? Especially in the cases of anorexia and bulimia, mm-hmm. you would have to have like actually physicians who are sort of in the know about eating disorders.
Yeah.
So that they can sort of work with you on getting the labs done, especially with anorexics, when they tend to gain weight, then there's a high probability of having cardiac problems, right? And so, I mean, that's really life-threatening. And so, I mean, you need to have a good physician that you work with, as well as nutritionist as well. So,
yeah. Okay. Well, thank you for being on today. Thank you for all this information you've shared. We're going to link in the show notes to the books that you mentioned and the websites that you mentioned as well. So anybody who's listening, that will be linked in the show notes. And I wanted to leave with a final question, because this, you know, this work can be really draining. And so I'm curious, like, what is something that you do right now for your own self-care?
I run.
You run? Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I love running. I just ran. I went down to DC and I ran the Cherry Blossom 10-mile race. It was so much fun.
Okay. I thought you said you ran down to DC. I'm like, wait, what kind of runner are you? But yeah. Well, that's beautiful. Yeah. I used to run too. I haven't been doing a lot of it recently. I have sort of an on and off relationship with running. My knee is usually the reason, but yeah, but I do enjoy it too. And okay. A final question. Tell us something that we wouldn't find on your Psychology Today profile.
I'm a baker. I love baking.
I see how that works together. Baking and running. That was my favorite part too, about running, just being able to eat like something delicious afterwards.
Yeah. So I love baking, making bread, making cakes. Muffins, brownies, cookies. Yeah.
Really? Okay. I think this is so fitting for this episode. So tell everybody where they can find you if they want to learn more, or maybe they want to reach out to you.
I don't have a website per se. I'm still very old school. But I'm part of the EDCAS eating disorders program at White. So you guys can, if you guys want more training, you guys can certainly do apply there. I can be reached at rosa.lim@gmail.com.
Thank you so much, Rosa. It was such a pleasure having you on today. And
thank you.
Maybe we can have you back on again. So there's just so much information that you shared today. I know that was just a little bit of what's out there. So thank you.
Thank you for having me, Diana.